Trigger warning. This episode discusses the murders and disappearances of children and also mentions child sexual abuse. Listener discretion is advised. Many crime documentaries on TV portray serial killers as being some sort of cold-blooded creature who only preys at night, like some kind of wild animal. I think the reason these programmes describe them this way is to try and put as much distance between them and us as possible, to lure us into a false sense of security that we will never come into contact with them and that we would know if we ever did see one in person. But this is far from the truth. To the outside world, these people seem to live very normal lives with normal jobs and normal families. They live on regular streets among unsuspecting neighbours, never in their wildest dreams imagining that they would be in such close proximity to someone capable of the most horrendous crimes. The man we will be talking about today was one of these individuals. He did the unthinkable. Sexually abusing and murdering children, yet he went undetected for over a decade, and even 40 years later, we still don't know for sure how many victims he had. Today, we will be discussing the crimes that we know he has committed, and the ones that he is either suspected or thought to have committed, as we uncover the crimes that are possibly connected to Mac Ray Edwards. Hello and welcome to the 62nd episode of the Uncover True Crime podcast. Each week, we uncover a different unsolved true crime case, ranging from missing persons, unsolved murders, Jane and John Doe's, and suspicious deaths. You can listen to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, and other podcast streaming apps. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @uncover_pod, on Instagram at @uncovertruecrimepod, and you can join the Uncover True Crime discussion group on Facebook. But without any further ado, let's uncover the cases connected to Mac Ray Edwards. This episode is part of my Connected series, where I discuss cases that are known to be or are suspected to be connected to each other. As there are so many victims in this case, I have decided to uncover the cases known to be connected to each other first, then we will talk about Mac Ray Edwards, and then the other cases that he is thought or suspected to be connected to. I think that way will flow best, but I am going to leave timestamps in the description if you want to listen to it in a different order. I would also like to take this opportunity to repeat the trigger warning that was at the start of this episode. Today, we will be discussing the disappearance, murder, and sexual abuse of over 11 children. Listener discretion is advised. The first case we are going to discuss today is Stella Nolan's. Stella Darlene Nolan was born on the 1st of January 1945 in San Diego, California. Her biological mother was a woman called Betty Jean Eccles, who was not married when she gave birth to Stella. It was extremely hard for unwed mothers in the 1940s, many of whom did not have the emotional or financial support to be able to raise a child on their own. Betty worked with a woman called Alina Nolan, and she knew that Alina and her husband Owen were desperate to be parents, but that their attempts had been unsuccessful. The Nolans agreed to adopt Stella and raise her as their own, and Betty left the state a short time later. Alina, Owen and Stella then moved to Redwood City, over 500 miles away, for a fresh start. They settled in a trailer park on South Atlantic Avenue, and Stella went on to attend the Colin P. Kelly School in Compton. Alina worked at a sandwich cart at a market, and Owen, who was a World War II veteran, was employed as a handyman, and while they were not financially well off, they managed, just like many other families do. They all loved each other and they made it work. That was until Stella disappeared when she was 8 years old. The 20th of June 1953 was the day before Father's Day, and Stella had made her father a card and a gift. Knowing that he would be working on Father's Day, she told her mother that she wanted to give him his gifts early. In a quote that seems rather ominous now, Stella told Alina, quote, "You know, Mummy, I think I'll give Daddy his card today. You can never tell what's going to happen," unquote. After giving her dad his gifts, she accompanied her mum to her job at the sandwich stand, something which she did frequently. When they arrived, Stella met up with her best friend, Barbara Ann Churchill, and the two played nearby. Alina told Stella to check in with her every hour so that she knew she was safe. Stella did this until 9 p.m, which is when Alina started to worry. She searched the entire market and found no trace of her daughter. She was eventually able to talk to Barbara, who said that she had walked away from Stella for a few minutes, and when she came back to play with her, she was gone. It is likely the 8-year-old Barbara had just assumed that Stella's mother was done with her work and that the two had gone home. Eileena's blood instantly ran cold as she knew that Stella would never just wander off. She knew that she had been abducted. She called the police and the LAPD started their search for her. Stella was unaware that she was adopted, however the Nolans did tell the police that she wasn't their biological daughter. They also told the police that her adoption was never made legal. They didn't sign any paperwork or consult with lawyers. The whole arrangement was very informal, meaning that legally, Betty could have come back and taken Stella whenever she wanted. The police were able to track Betty down in Texas. They discovered that she had since married and had another child and were able to rule her out as having any involvement in Stella's disappearance. Police tracked down other leads and even arrested Owen's nephew, as he reportedly gave inconsistent statements to the police, but he was also ruled out as being Stella's abductor. The Nolans were sitting at home, racking their brains as to who could have taken their daughter, when Eileena remembered a chilling interaction she and Stella had with a man about a week before she went missing. She told the police that a man approached them and said, quote, "You have a beautiful daughter. Is there any chance of my kidnapping, buying or stealing her?" Unquote. Understandably, Eileena was very freaked out by this, but she never saw the man again, so she tried to put it out of her mind until Stella disappeared. I don't know if she was able to give the police a description of this man, and I don't know if they were ever able to identify him. But, as we will get to later, they did identify her killer. Next, we are going to uncover the joint disappearances of Brenda Howell and Donald Baker. Brenda was born on the 19th of August 1943, and Donald was born on the 17th of October that same year. Donald lived on the 1700 block of Rockdale Avenue in Los Angeles, California, as did Brenda's sister Mary, her husband, and their two children. Brenda and presumably her mother had travelled from Fort Bragg to Azusa to visit Mary in the summer of 1956, and during their visit, she had become quite close to Donald. The families described it as puppy love, and I can imagine it would have been very cute to watch since they were both 13 years old. On the 6th of August 1956, Brenda and Donald were out playing on their bikes. They travelled to the San Gabriel Canyon, which was around 30 miles away. Now I know that this might seem like a long way from home for two unaccompanied 13-year-olds, but I want to put it out there now that they were not alone, but we will get to that later. When the two kids did not come home, the police were called, and the next day, Donald's jacket and Brenda's bike were found near the Morris Dam. Now, according to Google Maps, this is over 17 miles away from Glendora Mountain Road, which is where they were last seen. However, that is assuming they took the route right around the canyon. According to other sources, if you don't go around the canyon, it's only a quarter of a mile. I am aware that this is quite a discrepancy, however, that's the information I was able to find. The police thought that the two kids had run away together, knowing that Brenda would have to return to Fort Bragg at the end of the summer break, and this was probably going to upset both Brenda and Donald. Their families agreed, however, there was one member of the family who knew a lot more than they were letting on. And with that, let's uncover the next case, which is the murder of Gary Rocha. I'll admit, there is not a lot of information available about Gary Rocha or his case online. I couldn't even find his date of birth, just his age, which was 16 years old. All we really know is that on the 26th of November 1968, Gary was home alone when he was shot and killed in his parents' bedroom. The police thought that when he had returned from school at 3:30 p.m. that a burglary was taking place in his home in Granada Hills, and that he had interrupted the intruder and was killed as a result. The police did not connect his murder to any other crimes, and it was thought to be an isolated act of violence, but they were wrong. The next case we are going to discuss is the disappearance of Roger Dale Madison. He was born on the 13th of October 1953. He was a typical 15-year-old boy. He liked rock and roll music, played guitar, and loved animals. He lived with his parents, two sisters and two brothers on Sire Street in Salmar, California, which is where he was last seen on the 16th of December 1968. He left his house after having an argument with his dad and never returned. Like in Brenda Howell and Donald Barker's case, it was thought that he had run away. Again, the police were wrong. Just like with Gary Rocha, there is very little information on the next victim we will be discussing today, 13-year-old Donald Allen Todd. All we know is that he was last seen leaving his home in Tacoma, California on the 16th of May 1969, and he was later found by two kids, shot to death under a bridge around a mile and a half away from his home. That's literally it. However, it is possible this case did receive more coverage in the newspapers at the time, and that I was either unable to find them, or these articles are not available online. The last case we are going to talk about before we discuss the main suspect is the disappearance of 8-year-old Thomas Bowman. On the 23rd of March 1957, Thomas and several members of his family went on a day out at the Arroyo Cinco Canyon in Altadena, California. As the family were on the way back to their cars, Thomas shouted, quote, "I'll beat you to the car," unquote, and he ran ahead. He wasn't very far in front of them, however, there were a few corners between where they were when he ran ahead and the car, so he wasn't always seen by his family. Regardless, he wasn't out of their sight for very long, but by the time the rest of his family got to the car, he was gone. Over 400 volunteers and police officers searched the canyon for Thomas, thinking that he had gotten lost or injured, or maybe had succumbed to the elements, but he was never found. Not long after his disappearance, the Bowmans received a letter from someone claiming that Thomas was safe and well and was being cared for by a man, but they didn't reveal where he was or provide any clues to his whereabouts. Soon after that, another letter was sent to a local newspaper stating that Thomas was in Oklahoma, but the police still don't know who sent these letters, if they actually were written by his abductor to throw them off the scent, or if it was just a cruel hoax. The only other leads came from two witnesses. The first was a 10-year-old boy called Johnny Bond, who said that in the hours after Thomas's disappearance, he saw him crying with a dirty-looking man. I don't know where he saw Thomas, but the sighting was deemed as credible because he told the detectives that Thomas was wearing a Davy Crockett belt, which was in fact true, and this detail was never made public. The other witness, Alice Davidson, said that she had saw a crying boy matching Thomas's description with a weird-looking man with blonde hair. Again, I don't know where she saw the pair, and I also don't know if this sighting was confirmed or not. Now, I don't know exactly when, but at some point, an author called Weston DeWalt heard about Thomas's case, and it really stuck with him. Weston wasn't a true crime author. He had actually written a book called The Climb, Dangerous Ambitions on Everest, which is a book documenting the accounts of mountaineers who have climbed Mount Everest. I don't know what drew his attention to the case, but his involvement has been instrumental not only in Thomas's case, but in the connections between many of the other cases that we will discuss shortly. He saw the police sketch that Alison Davidson had helped the police create, and he knew that he had seen that face before, but for the longest time he couldn't figure out where. Until one day, it just hit him. He had once seen a picture of a convicted killer walking into court, and he knew it was the same man from the sketch. The man who had one day walked into a police station in Los Angeles, put a loaded gun on the counter, and confessed to the murders of Stella Nolan, Brenda Howell, Donald Baker, Gary Rocha, Roger Madison, Donald Allen Todd, and through Weston's subsequent investigation, he found that he had also written to his wife, confessing to the murder of Thomas Bowman. And with that, let us discuss the man that ties all these cases together, Mac Ray Edwards. Mac was born on the 17th of October 1918 in Arkansas, then relocated with his wife Mary to California in 1946. He worked as a heavy goods operator and helped construct freeways all over California. He and his wife adopted two kids, a boy and a girl, whose names and ages are understandably not available online. We don't know much else about him, but it seemed that he came across as a normal guy, a blue-collar suburban man. That was until the 6th of March 1970, when he walked into a police station, put a loaded gun on the counter and said that he wanted to talk to a policeman. He got to talk to a detective, which is when he admitted to the murders. The reason that he did this was because earlier on that day, Mac and an unnamed 15-year-old boy kidnapped three teenage girls from their home in Salmar, California. Mac then drove 15-year-old Valerie, 14-year-old Sydney, and 13-year-old Jan to Banquet Canyon, and it's likely that he was planning on sexually assaulting and murdering the girls. Thankfully, two of them managed to escape, and knowing that his time was up, he let the third girl go. Mac lived very close to the three sisters, and they knew exactly who he was, so he knew that they would be able to identify him, so he decided to turn himself in before the police came and arrested him. When he told all of this to the policeman, he said that he had remorse for what he had done, which is why he had turned himself in. He told Sergeant George Rock, quote, "I have a guilt complex. I couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep, and it was beginning to affect my work. You know, I'm a heavy goods operator. That long grader that I'm using now costs a lot of money. $200,000. I might wreck it, or turn it over and hurt someone," unquote. Before I get into the rest of the case, I just want to give a bit of a personal opinion here. When Mac Ray Edwards discusses the crimes that he has committed, he often talks about the guilt and remorse that he feels. Personally, I think that this is all utter bullshit. If Mac had felt any guilt or remorse for what he had done, he could have stopped. but he didn't. His crime spree went on for well over a decade. He admitted to killing over 6 children, and the only reason he turned himself in was because he knew he was going to get caught anyway. So he decided to turn himself in and control the narrative, to admit the crimes that he wanted to admit to. He didn't have to hurt any of these children. As we will get into in a minute, he had the option to save Stella Nolan. He didn't have to hurt or kill any of these children, but he did so anyway. So yeah, I've got no qualms with saying that I think that his talk about guilt and remorse is a pile of complete and utter bullshit. But anyway, I'll get back to the episode. He told the police where the 3 sisters were, and thankfully they were found physically unharmed, but they were very distressed, and understandably so. He then went on to describe his crimes to Sergeant Rock, who very quickly realised that he was dealing with the worst child serial killer in California history. He started with Stella Nolan. He had clearly been watching her and her mother for a while, because he said that he waited until just the right time when her friend walked away and she was out of her mother's sight, when he lured her into his car. He then drove her to Angley's Forest, which is over 5 hours away. Enough time, you would think, for the guilt or remorse to hit you, to think, what the actual fuck am I doing, and let her go. But he didn't. And that little girl must have been absolutely petrified for those 5 hours. When they finally arrive, he sexually assaulted and strangled Stella before leaving her under a bridge. However, Stella had actually survived her attack, something that Mac hadn't realised until he returned to the scene the next day to bury her body. Stella had managed to crawl around 100 yards from where he left her, but she was unable to move or talk when he had returned. At this point, Mac could have realised what a terrible thing he had done and gotten her help, but instead, he stabbed her. And that's where she died. He then buried her body in the forest. During his confession, Mac told the police where her body was, and they did find her. Sadly, Mac's confession came 17 years after Stella's murder, and Eileena had died 11 years before Mac's confession, so she never knew what happened to her daughter. Her father Owen was still alive, and he laid her to rest in the Fort Rosecrans National Cemetery right next to Eileena. Owen died 2 years after Mac's confession, and he was buried beside his wife and daughter, so the family of 3 could rest in peace together. He then went on to confess to Brenda Howell and Donald Baker's murders. When I discussed this case earlier, I alluded to the fact that someone close to the kids knew exactly what had happened to them, and this was indeed the case. See, Brenda Howell was Mac's wife's sister, essentially meaning that Mac was her brother-in-law, and she had been staying in their house on her visit from Fort Bragg. Mac also knew Donald, as they lived on the same street. I believe that Mac wouldn't have wanted to commit such a crime in his own home, and he thought that asking Mary to travel miles away with him to somewhere more secluded would probably creep her out, and she would have refused. So he actually paid Donald Barker money to take Brenda up to that canyon where they were last seen, because he knew that she trusted Donald. Donald probably thought nothing of it and was happy to accept the deal, which is exactly what he did. He suggested to Brenda that they should go to the canyon, and Brenda gladly accepted. Mac followed them in his car on the way there, and when they arrived, he somehow separated the pair. He killed Donald first, but I think it's clear that he just wanted Donald out the way, as his real target was Brenda. Brenda saw him kill Donald and she started screaming, so he killed her quickly, although I don't think that was part of his plan. Next, he spoke about Gary Rocha. The police were initially surprised that he had confessed to this crime, because his murder didn't appear to have anything in common with the other 2 cases. Gary was shot at home, he wasn't lured away anywhere, and he was a bit older than Mac's other victims. However, the pieces all fell into place when Mac explained that his real intention when he broke into the house was to kidnap, assault, and murder Gary's younger sister, but she wasn't in at the time. Gary came home when Mac was still in the house, so he killed him in order to prevent him from reporting the break-in and the attempted abduction to the police. Next, he confessed to Roger Madison's murder. Roger's family were very surprised that Mac was responsible for their son's murder, because they knew him. They lived on the same street as Mac and his family. Roger was even friends with Mac's son, a fact that Mac likely used to his advantage when he lured Robert to a bridge near the Thousand Oaks Freeway, which is where he killed him before burying him under the freeway, which was under construction at the time. A construction project that Mac himself was actually working on. When he confessed to Roger's murder, he also confessed to Donald Allen Todd's. The motive for Roger and Donald's murders are not clear, however it is unclear why he did any of these truly horrific crimes, other than the fact that he was a predator and a truly evil human being. Mac told the police the location of each of his victims, and although they already had Gary Roche and Donald Allen Todd's body, the only other victim they were able to find was Stella Nolan. But as he had disposed of his victims under freeways as they were being built, it was very hard to recover the other remains. As a result, he was only charged with Stella, Gary and Donald's murder. However, the police did believe that his confessions to the other murders were credible and genuine, so the investigation into who killed them ceased. They just didn't think they would be able to prosecute him without their bodies. His first court hearing happened just over a week after the confessions, and even though he tried to plead guilty, the judge refused the guilty plea and instead entered a plea of not guilty on his behalf. The most likely reason for this is that Mac couldn't be sentenced to death if he simply pled guilty. He would have to be found guilty by a jury in order for him to be sentenced to death. Many people believed that Mac deserved the death penalty, including Deputy District Attorney David Kenner, who told the jury, quote, "If ever there was a case that cried out for the imposition of the death penalty, this is the case. This defendant has forfeited whatever right a person has to live in this society." Unquote. Mac actually wanted to be sentenced to death, as he told the same jury, quote, "My attorney got a bit mixed up and pleaded for my life. I want the chair. That's what I've always wanted. I told them that when I went to the police station. They didn't say that in court. This is sadistic to bring these parents and other witnesses down here and put them through this." Unquote. The fucking audacity that this piece of shit has to talk about how the prosecution are being sadistic and what they are putting the victims' families through. That is some absolutely fucked up logic that I can't even begin to comprehend. Mac was found guilty, and on the 5th of June 1970, he was sentenced to death in the gas chamber. As with all death penalty cases, there are mandatory appeals that you have to go through before a prisoner can be put to death. This gave Mac a lot of time to confess to more murders to his fellow inmates. I don't know if he ever gave specific names, but he said that he killed 22 children, not the 6 that he had confessed to. Mac was later questioned about this, but he remained adamant that the real number was indeed 6. During his time in prison, Mac tried to end his own life on 3 occasions, and on the 3rd attempt, he was successful. On the 30th of August 1971, he was found hanging in his cell, aged 53. It wasn't until after his death that his wife, Mary Edwards, received a suicide note from Mac, where he confessed to killing 8-year-old Thomas Bowman, the last victim we spoke about before we went on to talk about Mac Edwards. Just as a reminder, Thomas Bowman was the little boy who went missing on a family day out at the Aroa Cinco Canyon. The only part of the note that has been released to the public reads, quote, "I was going to add one more, and that was a Tommy Bowman boy who disappeared in Pasadena. But I felt I would really make a mess of that one, so I left him out of it." Unquote. I believe the slayer only came to light when Weston DeWalt, the author who made the link between Thomas's case and Mac Ray Edwards, interviewed Mac's widow in either 2006 or 2007. I don't believe that she had ever turned this note over to the police. Now, I understand that suicide notes are very personal, but I think that if they can solve murders, especially the unsolved murders of children, that note should have been turned over to the police so they could have used it as evidence to try and give the Bowmans and maybe a dozen other families some closure. I really do hope that that letter is in the police's custody now. While many people might consider these cases closed, the police disagree for a few reasons. First of all, there was 12 years between Brenda and Donald's murders and Gary Roche's. Very rarely do serial killers take that long of a break, so the police tried to track down his movements between 1956 and 1968. According to Namus, there are currently 13 missing children who were aged between 6 and 15, which appeared to be Mac's preferred age range, who went missing in California in this time period. According to the Charlie Project and various other sources, Mac is a suspect in at least 5 of these cases, including Thomas Bowman's disappearance. That leaves 7 other missing persons cases. One of them, John Arthur Butler, is thought to have drowned as there were marks on his surfboard that he was using that day that indicated a drowning. I was very conflicted about this case as he went missing on Newport Beach, which is where another one of his suspected victims was found. However, I will get into that a little bit later. I am still conflicted about this, but to be honest, that's about as much information as we have about John's case, other than the fact that that the date of his disappearance is listed as being the 21st of August 1961. I'm also not going to talk about Donish Redmond's disappearance, as she technically didn't go missing in California. She is known to have left the state of California with her boyfriend Michael Griffin, who is also missing, but they were on their way to Nevada to get married and their car was found in Arizona. One other case listed on Namus in this time period is that of Henrietta Cruz Avila. However, it is suspected that she fled an abusive marriage, and there have been several indications that she was alive at least for some period of time after she went missing. While she may have met with foul play since, it is impossible to know when, and as there is a strong possibility that she disappeared of her own accord, I'm not going to include her disappearance in this list either. That leaves four missing persons cases, which I'm going to go over now. However, I would like to point out that these are the cases listed on Namus where Mac Ray Edwards has not been mentioned as a suspect or person of interest. It is just my own pure speculation that he may be involved. I am going to discuss the cases where he is an actual suspect in a minute, but for the time being, here are the four remaining cases that are listed on Namus. Lynn Bernadette Laurie was last seen in Long Beach on the 17th of August 1964. There are few details publicly available in her case, but it has been released that she might have left the area with an adult male. I don't know if the police know who this man is, and if they don't, if they have a sketch of him, or whether or not she went with him voluntarily. Again, this man might have been Mac, or it might not have been. On the 4th of November 1967, Mark Walden Wilson went missing from his home in Meadow Valley, California, and had told his parents he was going to hitchhike his way to Quincy, a town around 7 miles away, so he could go see a movie, but he was never seen again. There are also very few details available on his case, but to me, it seems most likely that he either ran away or met with foul play from a hitchhiker who he got a ride from. Whether or not that person was Mac Ray Edwards cannot be determined. Finally, Sammy Jackson and Alfred Grimes were 13 and 14 respectively when they went missing on the 14th of September 1968. They travelled from their home in Marina, California to go fishing at Fisherman's Wharf just over 100 miles away. They got the bus at 4:30 a.m. and did indeed make it to their destination, but they were never seen again. It is not thought that they ran away, as they didn't really take anything with them other than the items that they would need for that day. It has been speculated that the boys drowned, however there are no witnesses to this, so it cannot be confirmed. While it is possible that they are lost at sea, they may have been murdered, perhaps by Mac Ray Edwards or perhaps by someone else. Mac did manage to get most of his victims into a fairly secluded area before killing them, so it's possible that he was in the area, stumbled across the boys fishing, and killed them in a crime of opportunity. But again, we don't know that. I would like to repeat that Mac Ray Edwards has never been listed as a suspect or person of interest in the disappearances of these four children. This is all my personal speculation from the cases I was able to find on Namus. Now I am going to talk about the cases that Mac Ray Edwards has been named as a suspect in, of which there are four, not including the disappearance of Thomas Bowman, who we have already spoken about. I'm going to start with the disappearance of Bruce Kramen. Bruce Howard Kramen was born on the 21st of July 1953, and he was 7 years old when he went missing on the 12th of July 1960. Bruce was camping in the Angeles National Forest with around 80 other people from the YMCA in Los Angeles County. On that fateful day, he was playing with a bunch of other children around 300 yards from the campsite, when he somehow got separated from the other children and was never seen again. It only took a few minutes for people to realise that Bruce was missing, but despite their searches, he was never found. The police thought that Bruce had gotten lost in the forest or had died from an injury, as the area where he went missing was full of cliffs and rugged terrain, but his body was never discovered. Apart from the fact that Bruce was a young boy who went missing in California, I think the reason why he is a suspect in this case is because Bruce went missing from the same national forest where Mac had killed Stella Nolan and hidden her body. Next, we are going to talk about the disappearance of Kara Tompkins. Karen Lynn Tompkins was born on the 25th of July 1950 and was the oldest of three children. Her father was in the Navy, so he was offshore a lot, but day to day she lived with her mother, grandmother, and her brother and sister in a trailer park in Torrance, California. She was 11 years old when she went missing on the 18th of August 1961. That day, Karen and her brother went to an arts and crafts class at Halldale Avenue Elementary School in Harbour Gateway. Sources differ as to whether or not they took the family dog to the class or if their dog followed them there. In any case, Karen's brother left the class early to take the dog back home, but Karen stayed behind. She left at 5:30 p.m. to walk home with a couple of wagons filled with toys and the art that her and her brother had made that day. The trailer park where she lived was only about 4 blocks away from the school, so it shouldn't have taken her long to get home, but she never arrived home and was never seen again. An unnamed 40-year-old man was arrested in connection with her disappearance after blood was found on his underwear, but this was before DNA testing was really a thing, so they couldn't prove that the blood was Karen's. He was released and no charges were filed. Around a year after Karen's disappearance, on the 2nd of July 1962, an 11-year-old girl called Dorothy Gail Brown was riding her bike in the trailer park where she lived, which just so happened to be the same trailer park that Karen had lived in. She went out on her bike at 7 p.m. and when she hadn't returned by 8 p.m, her parents went out looking for her and they found her bike lying on the road around a block away, so they called the police and reported her missing. 2 days later, Dorothy's dress was found in the Coronado Del Mar neighbourhood near Newport Beach. Police decided to search the water at the beach and her body was found 150 feet away from the shore. It is thought that she'd be in the water for less than 12 hours before being found, but I don't think they could pinpoint where or how she had died, but they do know that she had been sexually assaulted. Her case was almost instantly linked to Karen's, as they were the same age, lived in the same trailer park, and went missing in almost the exact same place. I don't think they had any suspects in this case until 2007, when police started looking into the cases that Mac might have been connected to. It is believed that he killed both Karen and Dorothy, although Karen's body has never been found. Now we are going to discuss the last victim that might be connected to Mac Ray Edwards, Ramona Price. Ramona Price was born on the 24th of June 1956 and she was 7 years old when she went missing on the 2nd of September 1961. At the time, her family were moving house. Now, I don't know where their new house was, but their old house was on Oak Avenue in Santa Barbara. Ramona was very excited and told her dad she wanted to walk to the new house, which was over 7 miles away. Her dad thought she was kidding, but told her to go ahead. So Ramona walked up the road and her family never saw her again. Her parents reported her missing after they hadn't seen her for 30 minutes and the police started their search. A few witnesses said that they saw Ramona talking to a man in a grey 1953 Plymouth car, and a sketch of the man was created by a police sketch artist. Sniffer dogs tracked down her scent to Modoc Road near the 101 freeway, which was under construction, but that's where their trail stopped, and after that there was no trace of Ramona. There are a few reasons why the police suspect Mac and Ramona's case. First of all, the sketch of the man last seen with Ramona bore a resemblance to Mac, and he was known to drive a 1953 grey Plymouth. Also, he was working on the construction of the 101 freeway, which is where the sniffer dogs lost Ramona's trail. The disappearances of Brenda Howell, Donald Baker, Bruce Craman, Roger Madison, Ramona Price and Cara Tompkins were reopened in 2007. This was so they could try to conclusively link Mac to the cases that he didn't confess to and find the bodies of the victims that he did confess to. Weston DeWalt and LAPD officer Vivian Flores contacted a company that Mac had worked for, Caltrans, to see if they could find out what jobs Mac was working at the time of each of the murders, to see if they could find the bodies of any of the missing children. Since Mac had confessed that he had buried most of his victims in the constructions of the freeways that he was working on at the time, one man who used to work for Caltrans kept impeccable records that helped a lot. He even kept note of the weather during certain jobs, because if the weather was really bad, the construction had to be paused until the conditions improved. In Mac's confessions, he said that on the night he buried Roger Madison's body under the Thousand Oaks Freeway, it was raining very heavily, and he even had the nerve to call Caltrans to help him get his car out of the mud. The note from Caltrans confirmed this, as they weren't able to work on the Thousand Oaks Freeway when Roger was killed due to the weather, and Mac would have known that, which is probably why he picked that spot to bury him. In 2008, cadaver dogs were brought out to the area where Roger was thought to have been buried, and they got a hit. However, due to safety reasons, they couldn't excavate the freeway, and Roger's body can't be recovered, even though it is pretty clear that this is where he is buried. During the investigation, police discovered that Mac had also worked for another company called Cursed Construction, and there was an equipment yard of theirs very close to where Tommy Bowman disappeared. yet another connection between his case and Mac Ray Edwards. In 2011, the Santa Barbara Police Department announced that they were interested in an area of the Galeto Freeway overpass in relation to Ramona Price's investigation. This freeway was also under construction at the time that she disappeared, and it is likely that Mac was on that construction team. Cadaver dogs did again pick up a scent on the freeway, but they couldn't decide whether or not to excavate. I don't think they did excavate the freeway for the same reasons why the search for Roger's body had to be stopped. For safety concerns. It is horrifying to think that there are all these bodies of children buried under freeways all over California, and it is likely that some of them may never be recovered. But we can try to spread awareness to their cases and try to give the family members who are still alive today some sense of closure. Mac Ray Edwards may be responsible for more crimes that we didn't even cover today, and I don't know if we will ever know the full extent of his crimes, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. If you have any information on Mac Ray Edwards' whereabouts during the 1950s or 1960s, or if you have any information on the murders or disappearances that we have spoken about today, please call the Sheriff's Department Homicide Bureau on 323-890-5500, or you can call the LAPD Cold Case Division on 213-847-0970. I think that this might be one of the darkest cases I have ever covered on this podcast, so I want to thank you all for listening to the very end. I know it couldn't have been easy. It wasn't easy for me recording this. I have had to stop and pause on several occasions because I either got really, really upset or really, really angry. And I also want to apologise for my language during this episode. I know that I have sworn on this podcast before, but generally speaking, I do like to keep it clean and kind of professional sounding. But I just couldn't help myself when talking about this man and the awful crimes that he has committed. However, that is all the information I have to share with you today. Thank you for listening till the very end. Please stay safe and have a good night.